throughout the plagues of 19th century Europe and America, poor people still kept coming to cities because that's where economic possibilities were. They are about equivalently poor as many people in the developing world today who assuredly will make the same decision that Europeans and Americans did, which is they'll choose earning a living in a city despite the risk of disease over running away to some far-flung spot.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. The remarkable growth of cities in developing economies asks some important questions of policymakers. Can we feed everyone in those cities? Can we provide jobs, sanitation, electricity? Can we keep the citizens healthy? And what happens if those urban environments continue to grow? Well, these problems are as old as the cities themselves, and that means thousands of years old. In a recent paper, Ed Glaser of Harvard points out that while technology has changed much about urban life, developing cities can still learn a lot from our urban past. And Ed's here today. Ed, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Ed, I said that we can learn a lot from developing cities. This is what you are arguing, but so much has changed about the way we live. Can we still draw that line from the past to the present?
So much has changed, and there are vast cultural, geographic, technological differences between developing world cities today and the cities of the past. But there are still a lot of valuable lessons despite those differences. It's not as if the Western past offers a how-to manual. Mm. Often they show the path not to take. Often they show critical errors that were made, but not use that history to not rely upon the wisdom that, you know, thousands of years of fumbling in the urban dark to try and make density livable. To not use that history is, I think, terribly unwise.
What was the limitation on how cities grew, their success in the past? Was it food or transport or disease?
The dominant problem historically has always been feeding a large number of people who didn't themselves work the land. And so the limits on city growth were really the limits on getting the food, growing the food, and distributing the food. Now, there are also the limits that come from density itself, that come from the role of cities as the nodes on the world's great lattice of travel and trade. And those downsides include, most obviously, contagious disease, which would sometimes check the growth of cities. Think about the plague of Athens, which struck that city in 430 BCE and really derailed its attempt to dominate the Mediterranean world. Mm. But for most of history, the question was, where would you get the food? Now, megacities of the past solved that mostly by conquest, right? So it's not as if ancient Rome, the largest city in European history until the modern era, until really 19th century London, was some great trading nexus that was manufacturing vast numbers of goods that it would sell in order to import grain. No, it had its legions, and its legions conquered Spain, and its legions conquered Egypt, and these were breadbaskets which were brought to the capital. As you go forward in history, it's again the megacities, whether Chang'an in China, Baghdad under the Abbasid caliphs, Edo under the Tokugawa shoguns. These are all ultimately imperial cities in the sense that they are imposing their own will on the hinterland and bringing food in that way. Smaller cities, of course, did trade, but they were likely to be much smaller. And then gradually you get, you know, cities that are massive just because of their manufacturing power. But that's really a 19th century phenomenon.
I mean, a lot of the discussion in the last year, certainly in rich countries, has been about the flight from cities. Is it all over for big cities? Are we still saying there will be a role for megacities? These will still exist in developing countries?
Well, in developing countries, certainly. I don't think the rush to the Hamptons, or I don't know what the UK equivalent would be, but is likely to be the fate of Kinshasa anytime soon. And indeed, COVID is much less deadly than cholera was. That's actually another lesson from our own past. You know, throughout the plagues of 19th century Europe and America, poor people still kept coming to cities because that's where economic possibilities were. They are about equivalently poor as many people in the developing world today who assuredly will make the same decision that Europeans and Americans did, which is they'll choose earning a living in a city despite the risk of disease over running away to some far-flung spot.
Now, looking at those cities that are built around manufacturing, where the jobs are, they've historically been fairly tightly packed because, well, it's quite difficult to get very far in them. It's hard to get around. Is this still going to be the case for low, middle-income countries? Are those cities still going to be packed tightly together?
So the fundamental lesson on this is that cities reflect the transportation technology that is dominant, often in the era in which they're built. So because cities last, you have parts of European cities, parts of the older American cities that really reflect the age of the pedestrian, the age in which poor people walk to work. And so they really are packed together. And you often have cases in which the poor lived closer to jobs than the rich did, because the rich would have access to horse-drawn omnibuses, or if they were very rich, to stagecoaches, whereas the poor were trudging to work. And so they would pay more. It would be more valuable to use land to create a tenement to build up than it would be to allocate that to a mansion for the wealthy. Now, of course, almost everywhere in the world today, it's the age of some form of internal combustion engine, maybe supplemented by rail. But in many developing world cities, the bus rapid transit systems have proven to be much more cost effective than rail. So it's really the age of the bus in some sense in the developing world. And so densities are bus densities. You typically have relatively close packed in areas around, you know, because people need to walk to where they can pick up the bus. But then minibuses or BRTs or something like that are still taking you in. So it's not really far flung in the way that you would have in a sort of wildly low density American exurb, which is really built around the automobile moving on lots and lots of infrastructure. But it's not nearly as compact as the cities of ancient Europe.
We tend to fret in high-income countries about the last mile problem because we worried about whether our internet's going to be fast enough. But I was interested, reading in your paper, you were arguing that there have been plenty of last mile problems in the past about other types of infrastructure, and that's a limit on the potential of cities. Is this still the case?
Absolutely. The last mile problem is an old problem. Anytime you have a form of infrastructure that doesn't reach out into everyone's homes, automatically you have some need to connect to it. In fact, we were just in some sense discussing it around subway lines, right? There's a last mile problem of walking to the subways that keeps the houses dense around the subway stop. I came to thinking about this problem and came to using the history of the West because I was interested in the last mile problem in Zambia, in Lusaka. And there, the problem is you have water mains. The water mains are built by well-meaning, you know, Millennium Development Account type institutions. And then it charge $1,000 for a full connection. And per capita income, when I was there in Zambia, was below $2,000. And so a $1,000 connection, that's a lot of money. And so people quite understandably decide to stick with their shallow wells and their boreholes. But of course, that means the whole investment didn't reap the benefits that the donors thought that it would. Now, if the donors had known a little bit more of our own history, they would have understood that this is an entirely predictable problem, because that's exactly what happened with the Croton Aqueduct for the first 25 years of its creation. So I was reared on a tale of engineering triumphalism, that New York had been a filthy place, and then the wonderful engineers had come and created this magnificent piece of infrastructure, the Croton Aqueduct. And then all of a sudden, the clean waters have come in, sewers had taken the waters out, and all of a sudden, New York was safe and clean and hygienic. Well, for 25 years after the Croton Aqueduct, New Yorkers were still dying of cholera. My great-great-great-grandfather died of cholera in the 1849 New York outbreak, which I didn't know until I started studying some of this history.
Gosh.
And the reason why is that New York had a heck of a last mile problem, that once again, they were charging money to connect to the water system. Once again, poorer New Yorkers, often in this era refugees from starving Ireland, they decided they would stick with their shallow wells, they would stick with their pit latrines, and they would continue to die of cholera. After all, it's not as if they were reading the latest message from Dr. John Snow about the waterborne nature of cholera in 1854. And so they continue to die. And it's not until you have this amazing institution, the Metropolitan Board of Health, which comes in 1866. It's led by one of the real pioneers of urban hygiene in the 19th century, Dr. Stephen Smith of New York, who actually goes out and documents this problem in New York, documents the last mile problem, that you have an institution in place which essentially fines tenement owners who don't connect to the water system. It's a Pigouvian tax, if you will, for, you know, taking the risk of not connecting. And then New York starts connecting, death rates start going down. Clean water really was the most important thing that governments did during the 19th century. Now, it's not quite as obvious how vital this is, because we now have rehydration therapy to deal with cholera. We have antibiotics to deal with other waterborne diseases. But I at least, you know, think that if there's one lesson of the COVID-19 pandemic, it's that a disease that starts anywhere can go anywhere, right? So something that starts in an Indian sewer can come to Indiana. And that means that we really don't want to be creating as many antibiotic resistant superbugs as we currently are by just trusting to antibiotics to get rid of whatever waterborne diseases occur. There really is a case for wealthy world donors investing much more in developing world sewer systems and developing world water systems. But of course, those investments need to be coupled with smart means of solving the last mile problem, which either needs to be a subsidy or some form of a penalty, like this fine on the tenement owners that New York imposed, or both.
There's a lot of people migrating to cities all over the world at the moment, and it means that a lot of the infrastructure is pretty informal, to say the least. It's very hard to work out in many cities when you go there. Who exactly owns what? Does history tell us that establishing ownership rights is important for a successful city?
Gosh, it sure was in Western cities. So in particular, over land, infrastructure was often creatively maintained by different entities. The entities all owned the infrastructure. It was pretty clear what rights they had. But, you know, sometimes it would be the full-on local government themselves. Sometimes it would be a turnpike trust. This was a common institution in 18th century England. So this was a local community nonprofit that would run a road. Sometimes it would be a private entity. And sometimes it would be a parastatal, like the Croton Aqueduct Commission, for example, that would be apart from executive authority, but reasonably politically independent, able to do things a little bit on their own. One of, I think, the lessons about parastatals, and I think very much the developing world needs to think about it, is they can do well, but they can also go very wrong. We know that as well. And it's really important to have someone in charge who has a reputation to lose. It's rare that you have financial incentives for this that are strong enough. So you really need someone who is doing it because they're enhancing their reputation in a global context and so care about it deeply. Now, in the context of land, most of the land involved has development has been private. There's often public work that's needed to create the grid, for example. Paul Romer, for example, has been very active lately in sort of advocating for grids in the developing world. And I think he's absolutely right. You want to clearly set out what is public land and then protect it. But in terms of private development, the common law system of property rights was incredibly valuable. And it's easy to forget how complicated our property rights are. It's not as if a property right is a single thing. What we normally think of as ownership over a piece of land is a nexus of property rights that includes the right to build things, the right to occupy it, the right to evict people, the right to alienate it by selling it, by renting it, by using it as some form of collateral for a mortgage. Rarely are these rights perfect and absolute. So, for example, in many parts of the developed world, the right to rent is limited by rent control or forbidden altogether. The home that I am in right now is a second home of my brother-in-law, which when he built, the county forbid him from renting this property. So he has the right to occupy it, but as part of being able to build it, he is unable legally to rent it. Now, we know that in the developing world, these property rights are often an absolute morass, and it makes it very difficult to do essentially what the developed world did, which is you assemble the land, you put in an awful lot of capital on top of that land, and then you create relatively hygienic settings for lots of people to occupy a small amount of land, right? So that was the normal feature of how our cities grew great in the late 19th century, how they built tenements that went to five or six stories, usually without elevators. And then after World War II, we had sort of large glazed brick structures that sprung out of providing homes for ordinary people. That's much harder to do if you don't know who owns the land. And so you do have settings, of course, where people will, I mean, I think in some sense it's a beautiful local institution. You know, for example, in the township of Alex in Johannesburg, you buy a plot of land and then you gradually fill in steel shacks. And those shacks run rented for, when I was there a couple years ago, $80 a month or so. And so you have local capitalists that are doing this. And maybe that's the right institution, but it certainly looks very different than the developed world policy. And that system in the developed world is much harder. Once you build some large structure, someone is able to take it from you, or you just don't have any right to build that large structure at all. Or when you build it, you don't have a right to rent it. Or when you rent it, you don't have a right to evict someone who doesn't pay. All of these things are going to limit the ability to provide inexpensive rental housing to ordinary people.
Yes, which really leads us on to the idea that we learn at school that if places are badly governed, then it leads to conflict and corruption and sometimes wars. I mean, that's basically more or less my entire history education. Are there lessons that we could take from history on the importance of institutions as a way to develop cities successfully? Because, of course, institutions are very hard to change, aren't they?
They are. And they were built in the 19th century often to make cities livable. I'm sorry for the shameless plug. I have a new book called Survival of the City coming out on...
You've earned it, Ed.
September 7th. Thank you. Thank you, Tim. And one of the claims that we make in it is basically from 500 CE to 1800 CE, governments did almost nothing that was actually benign. They were essentially in the business of conquer each other, except I guess if you consider fighting other people who are trying to conquer you as being benign, that's basically all that they did. Starting around 1800, you suddenly have this thing where governments start evolving in ways that actually protect their people. And urban infrastructure is a major part of that. It's funny, you know, I had always associated Benjamin Disraeli, the British prime minister, with empire, right? That's a, you know, one of the less attractive features of Disraeli. His high point, if his low point was, you know, various Indian imperial actions, his high point was a magnificent speech he gave during the summer of the Great Stink in 1858, when Thames was a fetid swamp, I think those are his words, and he was arguing that it was time for the British government to take a stand and fight for cleaner water in London. And that is what governments did in the 19th century that was actually good, and that required not just engineering, but actually building various forms of institutions that actually made them work. Now, this was a struggle. So in the late 18th century, it still seemed to people that in a great city, you could do it entirely with private waterworks. Mm-hmm. So in the 1790s, and there had never been a large public water system since medieval times in Europe. So they're all building things from new. This is long before Baron Haussmann and his sewers in Paris. So in the 1790s, there's a yellow fever epidemic that comes on the cities of the eastern seaboard of America. Philadelphia, going ahead of its times, does a public water system. New York does not. The reason why, by the way, it's a little bit odd, the story of yellow fever and water. Yellow fever is, of course, a mosquito-borne disease. It's not at all a waterborne disease. It was associated with water mostly because people get really thirsty right before they die. And then, of course, the push for water occurred later with cholera, not because people understood the waterborne nature of the illness, but instead because of the miasma theory of disease. So there were two primary theories of how disease was spread in early 19th century Europe and America. One was contagion, which was actually right. The other was miasma. It was the evil airs, the malodorous fumes that came out of the ground. But the miasma theory, while wrong on science, was actually right on public health, because what they argued for was cleaning up the swamp, getting clean water in there, you know, draining areas, and getting rid of the bad waters was totally useless. Getting rid of the swamp reduced the number of mosquitoes who could spread yellow fever, and it reduced the ability of water to spread cholera. So 1790s New York believes that they need better water. Aaron Burr, the same Aaron Burr who would later, of course, shoot Hamilton on the shores of the Hudson. Before that, he hires Hamilton to be his lawyer, and he gets Hamilton to convince his buddies on the Federalist City Council that having a public water system would lead to burdensome taxes. Those are the exact words. So, you know, neoliberalism in the 1790s. And instead of that, he has a private water company, the Manhattan Water Company, which is subsidized with the ability to create a bank. Bad idea then, terrible incentive system, right? You give an entity that you're asking to do a public service, an alternative activity that's far more lucrative. Then and now, it did a lot of banking. Its descendant is J.P. Morgan Chase, which came out of the Chase Manhattan Bank, which came out of the Bank of the Manhattan Water Company. And it did very little water production in the course of its life. What it wasn't until much later, until the 1830s, when New York starts getting the Croton Aqueduct system. And that requires the creation of a public, again, a parastatal enterprise that actually does that. In some cases, private companies can do it, but it's not like there's ever a free lunch. Anytime you have a private entity interacting with the state, they will try to subvert the state. That is an automatic thing. And you can see that already in the Manhattan Water Company, right? You know, they're going to try and figure out how to get the state to give them more subsidy or to let them up their rates. Or if you start off with a competitive situation, two companies bidding for access to Manila's water system, once you get it into a bilateral agreement, there'll be a renegotiation and all of a sudden the terms will become much more favorable to the private water company. So, you know, there are times when you can handle private, but usually it requires a fairly sophisticated and robust public system to stand on the other side of that. And I think the larger lesson of this is there's no right answer for institutions. It's a terrible mistake to say that the lesson of history is that you should always privatize or you should always go public, right? Or you should always have a parastatal or it should always not be a parastatal. That is not the right answer. The right answer is you actually need to understand the local conditions. And that is ultimately the lesson of history. It is not that there's one right answer ever. It is that their answers need to be well-crafted to knowledge of conditions on the ground, to knowledge of the institutions that are there, if you're going to go around changing institutions, if you're going to go around improving them. We may know what we want. We may know that we want clean water. We may know that we want to somehow or other build and maintain sewers. But unless you know both your history, you know, the actual broad principles and what's actually going on in whatever developing world country or city that you're working in, you will not know enough to implement any policy that's worth implementing.
And we could talk about this for days, couldn't we? But I guess we have to stop now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim. Always a pleasure.
The paper's called What Can Developing Cities Today Learn from the Urban Past? Author, of course, Ed Glaser. It's NBER Working Paper 28814. Ed, give another plug for your book.
Book is out September 7th, Basic Books UK, Penguin Press US, Survival of the City. And it, of course, talks about cities in post-COVID, or at this point in time, it seems like still an ongoing COVID world.
Maybe we could have you back on again to talk about the book when that's out. Let's see what we can do. But thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Tim.
This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform. And our past episodes, as ever, are at voxdev.org.